Welcome back to another episode of Angel Insights brought to you by Syndicate Room. This is the show that delves inside the world of early stage investing to reveal the tips, tactics and strategies of the investors themselves. And I'm delighted to welcome Katie Levitan to the show today. Now, Katie is the investment manager at Jam Jar Investments, the Innocent Drinks founder's venture capital fund. And as for Katie herself, she's the former Innocent commercial category manager. Prior to Innocent, she looked after James Kahn's consumer investments and launched HB Prime Advantage. And if you enjoy the show today, then head over to syndicateroom.com where you can find the Investor Academy. However, without further ado, I'm delighted to welcome Katie Levitan at Jam Jar Investments. Katie, a huge pleasure to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I'd love to get the ball rolling by hearing how you made your way into the wonderful world of VC.
Sure. I was at university. And I was doing an unusual degree called Human Sciences, which basically mixes up a lot of different subjects. And I found myself spending most of my time at the business school. And this was kind of 2008, 2009. It wasn't as cool as it is now to be an entrepreneur or kind of attend entrepreneurial societies or activities at uni. So I was really lucky because I just had this natural interest. And I used to go to these talks with amazing entrepreneurs, and there literally used to be like three people in the room. I heard the founder of Moonpig genuinely in an enormous auditorium, and there were four of us sat there. I basically just was really inspired by all these different entrepreneurs and spent a lot of time just listening to them talk. At one of these talks was a guy called James Kahn, who at the time was on the Dragon's Den.
Absolutely. I've seen his car parked outside many times. He's got a personalized number plate, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's him.
That's the one.
He was doing a talk, and all my friends were, this was kind of mid-recession, so everybody was going into arguably very safe careers. So law and banking were particularly popular. I just couldn't bring myself to apply for any of them, even though I thought they sounded great. And, you know, I'd done an internship in law and my dad's a lawyer and big respect for those careers. There was something that I just couldn't quite bring myself to apply. So instead, I just used to go to these talks and went and heard James Kahn speak. And he just gave this absolutely amazing talk about how he'd started his business from a broom cupboard at 16 years old. He hadn't got any GCSEs. His dad had wanted him to go into his business and he decided to make his own way instead. Mm-hmm. And then here we were 20 years on and, you know, he was a very seemingly happy and successful multimillionaire. And I just thought it was fascinating. So I went up to him at the end of his talk and just said, you know, I don't know in what capacity, but I'd really love to work with you, maybe as an intern. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and he gave me this very kind of intense stare and he talks quite close to your face and asked me a few scary questions. And a few minutes on, basically invited me to an interview at his office. So I was kind of bright red, but thought that sounded quite exciting. Was interviewed by him and two other people in Mayfair. And at the end of the interview, he said, right, I'd love to give you an internship. It can either be in marketing, because I've got a big marketing team at my private equity firm, or it can be my venture team, because, you know, I like to make angel investments, and not only the ones that I do on the Dragon's Den, but outside of that as well, I've got a nice portfolio, and Stephen, who runs it for me, needs some help. So I said, can I do both? And he said, no, you've got to pick one, because, you know, it's always better to focus. Mm-hmm. And I thought venture sounds interesting. And I looked across the table and Stephen, the guy that ran the venture team, was sat there and he seemed really nice. So I said, I'll do venture. So a week after my degree, I started this internship at Hamilton Bradshaw, which was his private equity firm. Mm-hmm. Mainly did mid-cap private equity, but they had a small VC portfolio. I started working with Stephen, and three months later, at the end of my internship, they offered me my boss's job. So Stephen moved up and I became Stephen. So I basically had this baptism of fire where I was managing a portfolio of what came to be 10 businesses with huge variety of ability and sector. I mean, they were all within consumer as it happens, but there was huge breadth of experience and ability and industry with it between them. I just absolutely loved it. Mm-hmm. I did that for 2 years and then helped him launch a business for a year. So it was a fascinating time.
And then Jam Jar came about serendipitously through the business venture with James?
No, so I left Hamilton Bradshaw after 3 years. I approached Innocent and got a job on the commercial team. So I was, a large part of my degree was statistics. So it was largely on the basis of that in a commercial role, which was heavily statistics based. I did that for a few months. Good fortune, actually, that Richard at the time was doing some personal investments with Adam and John, his two Innocent co-founders. I got talking to him one lunchtime and I told him about my background, and he said, oh, that actually could be really helpful for us. Anyway, to cut a long story short, within 2 weeks, I was double hatting. So I was doing 60% of my time was investment management, 40% of my time was category management, which was my previous job. And then in July 13, Innocent Founders sold to Coca-Cola. So big exit, north of $500 million. Suddenly knew they were going to have a lot more time. Now they weren't running Innocent full time and a lot more money to invest. And they asked me to go with them and set Jam Jar up. So we all left together, went into it. So this was kind of the formalization of what we were doing, because they'd been investing as angels for about 5 years. We wanted to find the best consumer businesses and help the best consumer businesses because, well, partly from personal experience, the guys had had, they'd pitched their idea to the whole of London and everyone had said no to them. So there was personal understanding that this market was being underserved. Also, from an interest perspective, that's what we love. That's what we know.
So you're focused on consumer brands, but what's your average check size then? And do you have a geography specification?
There's a huge breadth of check sizes. So we'll do anything upwards from 50K to £1 million in a single round. Mm-hmm. And then we leave room for follow-on rounds. In terms of geography, we say in Europe. So that doesn't necessarily mean it has to be founded in Europe. Occasionally we get US brands that are expanding into Europe. But, you know, the main thing is that they're of the highest quality in team and idea. So, you know, as far as the US is concerned, because we're focusing our time here, that it's slightly suspicious if they approach us. So, you know, we have done some great deals from the US, Blue Bottle Coffee, Pop Chips, both US businesses, but it tends to be European businesses. And within that, there's an even greater kind of network within the UK. So many of our founders are British. We love Europe and, you know, Adam's experiences rolling out Innocent internationally. So we've got very relevant experience to Europe as well. Sometimes it's US businesses coming to Europe.
And one of your focus areas seems to have been food delivery with investments in the likes of Food Drop. So why do you think we've seen this space in particular explode recently? What's your thoughts on the rise of food delivery?
Yeah, so I think it's really interesting. There's been a kind of advancement within this space. So you had Just Eat, which was, you know, bringing a relatively simple tech platform into something that was totally kind of analog, in people were ringing up restaurants and ordering takeaways that way. So there was no delivery element. It was just a way for consumers to order something easily, and it aggregated all that choice in one place. And then you got the next wave, which is kind of the Deliveroos of the world. And we invested in Deliveroo basically because they were solving the next level of problem, which was there were many restaurants that weren't being served by Just Eat platform because actually they didn't have the means to efficiently deliver. And so actually Deliveroo came along with not only a tech platform that allowed consumers to order, but also with a back-end delivery system and fleet of drivers, which allowed efficient ordering. And from the consumer perspective, that was great because suddenly you've got all these restaurants that previously couldn't deliver, like Nando's and
Wagamama's,
Gourmet Burger King, Wagamama's, kind of much loved restaurants, suddenly delivered. So that worked really well. And it also works well from a brand perspective, because actually the restaurants are the brand. You know, you are the aggregator and you need to have a strong relationship with the consumer, but the restaurants are much loved in themselves. So it works really nicely. And, you know, Deliveroo, 25% incremental revenue to each of those restaurants. So they're an absolutely vital part of their mix. And that's how integral they've become. And I mean, they've done really well. They've just raised a $200 million round and they've grown very quickly over the last 2 years.
But what do you think then is going to happen to the plethora of other companies? Do you think it's a one company takes all market, or do you think there is room for a numerous amount of competitors?
Well, I think the beauty of eating is that everyone does it. And so actually there's huge room within food for a variety of different models. And as I say, I think there is a lot of experimentation and in some ways progression that's continually going on. So after delivery, you've got the next wave of companies who are trying to own the whole end-to-end experience. So they're not only doing delivery and having a platform, but they're also making the food themselves. You know, there's Pronto that's doing that, Fresh Flavors, there's a lot. And there's a lot in Europe as well. As a kind of side piece, you've got Farm Drop and Hubbub, who are trying to disrupt the entire food chain, which is even more ambitious, by cutting out the big retailers. So in Hubbub's case, to kind of revive the high street, and in Farm Drop's case, to help the farmers. So lots of interesting stuff going on, and I think there's lots of room for different things.
And you think that's the next generation, the one-stop shop?
Yes, but not in the sense that the older generation will be phased out.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, Just Eat is still very popular, even though there's huge room for Deliveroo, because I think they're different portions of the market and the offering is different. The reality is that people like variety in what they eat. You know, Deliveroo provides that variety, but equally Just Eat has a lot of different restaurants on its platform. And so I think the average consumer has a lot of spending power. And the main thing is they seem to be going online for their lunch increasingly. Mm-hmm. And so within that decision, there's a lot of commercial opportunity.
And often the problem with food delivery businesses like Deliveroo is to operate. They do operate with negative gross margins for the early days. Do you see this as a problem? And when do you think that the monetization tap needs to be kind of metaphorically turned on?
I definitely don't think it's a problem. I think it's a key part of their model because it's part of the consumer promise. In Deliveroo's case, they promise the consumer that they will get you your food in half an hour. For them to do that, they can't do it efficiently at the start before they've got a minimum mass of people in a city. And so actually, I think it's essential to operate at a loss at the start. Plus, obviously, if you're having an aggressive expansion, then you're going to be putting your money into new territories, even when older territories have become profitable in themselves. So in terms of monetization, I think it's a judgment call and depends on a lot of things, including the funding climate, because if there's funding and you're showing huge traction and actually the market has the money and the interest to support you on that journey, then there's less need to turn on the monetization tap. If the market's looking a lot drier and, you know, you really need to rely on more organic growth, then I think you need to be a lot more careful.
And talking of these amazing companies that you've backed, what's your deal sourcing like? How do you like to go about finding them?
We're very lucky in that a lot comes to us, largely because of my colleagues' reputation. So it helps that they've founded a much loved brand and it's a mass consumer brand. So actually, most people have some awareness or even tried an Innocent smoothie or juice. Mm-hmm. And so actually, every bottle of Innocent is an advertising tool for us for an entrepreneur, because if they're that way inclined and they start looking up what the founders are doing now, they'll soon see that actually we like to invest and help consumer businesses. So it works really nicely in that sense. Quite unusual in that sense also, because there's a huge amount of very successful entrepreneurs that go into investing, but sometimes the businesses are less well known and sometimes less well loved. So it kind of, each bottle is a live advert for us. And
at your stage, do you work with angels and angel networks?
Yeah, so I feel lucky actually, because I think we sit between angel networks and VC. We can have one foot in both camps and be quite happy. So, you know, often we're in rounds with just angels and often we're in rounds with VCs as well. Probably deeper pockets than many angels and more structure, but at the same time, we're probably more flexible than many VCs, potentially more hands-on than some of them, because we're such a small team. And, you know, we don't have LPs or anything. It's just our money. So that in itself gives us a speed and flexibility when we want to do a deal.
And does your work process differ when working with VCs and angels?
No, actually, it doesn't. We're a very flexible fund, so we don't
dictate that we have to lead, or, you know, we can lead, but we can also follow. We also have very entrepreneur friendly terms, because, you know, really we see ourselves as entrepreneurs first, investors second. You know, that often means there's not too much negotiation around legals. We can fit in with others. And in terms of our involvement itself, we also have a huge variety there. We can work with VCs or not. So, you know, we go right up to board representation, right down to a phone call a couple of times a year. It really depends what the entrepreneur wants, and that's who we're led by. So I think because everyone always has the interests of the company at the heart of their decisions, it means that either one works well with us.
And then before we dive into a quickfire round, returning to the consumer brands, are there any seeds of potential that you look for within a consumer brand that comes to you looking for investment?
We look for great products. The more evidence that you can give that the product is great, the better. So obviously, if you've already launched, lots of people love it and are raving about it and using it, then that's kind of indisputable evidence. But equally, sometimes you just have something that you have a really strong conviction that people are going to love. And if we are aligned with that and feel the same, then that's a winning formula as well. So I think products is absolutely key. And often we rely on other people in the round to do that technical DD. Our expertise is around understanding the consumer journey, what's going to work for consumers. And a lot of our time is spent testing products in that sense as consumers and with consumers.
And I'd love to dive into a quickfire round now. So your favourite book and why?
I love The Book Thief. It's a fiction book, but I'm a big fan of fiction. I think a lot of people underestimate fiction because they think that they have to like non-fiction to sound clever. But actually, I value imagination in entrepreneurs as much as in life. And The Book Thief, just an amazing piece of literature in my mind. You know, it can make you laugh and cry in equal measure.
And then this is taken from your strain of thought here. Who was the first person to give you your chance? Was it James Kahn?
Yes, I think it was professionally. And I'm very grateful to James, and I learned a lot from James. So I would say James Kahn, but also Stephen Mix, who was at the time ran James's portfolio for him. I think it's fair to, they both tie with first chance, but technically it was James.
And then your favourite blog or newsletter, what's your must reads?
I'm not going to pick one. The truth is, I'm honestly not a creature of habit. So I look at a huge variety of them, and it would be unfair to say that there's one that I read religiously, because there isn't. I basically have a feed in my inbox that where anything I've subscribed to goes into a to read. And then I have a set time every week where I browse through that folder. So I actually look across a huge spectrum of them.
And then finally, your most recent investment with Jamjar and why you said yes.
Babylon Health. We said yes because Babylon is a telehealth platform on your mobile that allows you to manage your health from one place, including having doctor's appointments via your mobile. It's a very interesting space. There's a precursor in the US in the form of Doctor on Demand. Mm-hmm. It's got a very inspiring CEO with a strong background in health. Really trying to disrupt a huge industry. It has lots of potential.
Well, fantastic. And Katie, thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing your incredible journey. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me.
And a huge hand to Katie for giving up her time today to be on the show. And if you enjoyed the show, then head over to syndicateroom.com, where you can find the Investor Academy. A huge thank you for all your support. We really do appreciate you tuning in. And we'd like to remind you that early stage investing is risky. Therefore, please ensure that you engage in the appropriate due diligence prior to making the investment. Thank you so much, as always, and we look very forward to seeing you next week.